National.
Okay.
This is NPR, National Prabhu Radio.
Fast.
Philosophical four calls.
We're throwing philosophical questions at each other and he's gonna answer them as quickly as he can.
If I can't answer, I get it done.
You're the material pool. Why is Krishna blue?
Why? Do you really mean that?
Yeah.
It's not like why this guy. See, there are two principles which are, in a sense, intent or opposing. One is necessity, and the other is freedom. For example, the sky does not choose to be blue, given the nature of the atmosphere, and the nature of sunlight, and the nature of our eyes. You have three factors. You have the nature of sunlight, the nature of the atmosphere, the nature of our eyes, we see the sky as blue. And the sky could not appear to us to be a different color, given the laws of nature as we now understand them. So, that's necessity. Given a set of circumstances, including states of existence, laws, and so on, given that situation, we have to see the sky as blue. Unless it's, you know, cloudy day, it's a clear sky, it's blue. In the sunlight. But Krishna is blue, not in the same way. Because if Krishna had to be blue, like just given the nature of God, he just turned out blue. That's just, you know, given the nature of God, it just turns out blue. Or given the nature of the atmosphere, the sunlight, and our eyes, we see the sky as blue. There's freedom. Like, why are you dressed a certain way? Because you chose to dress that way. So, things which are done freely are not done by necessity. I mean, you may say, well, it's necessary that I keep my job, therefore I'm doing this. But it's necessary given a certain set of values you have. So that you accept certain values and therefore you make a choice. You feel that it's necessary that you do something, therefore you accept that necessity. So there's necessity and freedom. So when we say, why is Krishna blue? The question cannot assume that Krishna is under certain deterministic laws, like the sky, because God is, according to sort of a generic definition of God, God is an infinitely free being. In fact, God is the freest being. And therefore, the question can't assume that, like some kind of causal chain, some type of determinism, where Krishna turned out blue. So that, therefore, the alternative is that he chooses to be that color. After all, reality is highly teleological. That's a very important point to keep in mind. I was just about to explain that. That no extra cost. The cost is already quite expensive, as you'll find out at the end of the program. So, the Greek word telos means a purpose, an end. And so teleology is the philosophical understanding that there are objective purposes in the world. In other words, we give ourselves certain purposes, like you may decide you want a college education, or you want to get married, or you want to paint your nose tangerine orange or something. So, in other words, you may decide you want to do something, so you assign yourself a purpose, you accept in your life a purpose. But those are subjective purposes, because if you decide you don't want your nose to be that color, then it's no longer a purpose you have. If you decide you don't want a college education, it's no longer your purpose. So based on our values, which may change, we accept or create purposes. But teleology says that apart from our subjective decisions, there are objective purposes for us and for the universe which exist independent of our opinions. In other words, you're born for a reason, so that you're born with a certain purpose. Whether or not you understand it or acknowledge it, it's still your purpose. It's still the purpose of your life, even if you don't know that or don't accept it. It's still the real purpose of your life. And the world is created with a purpose. The world doesn't evolve by chance, but actually the world was created purposefully to serve some purpose. So that even the sky being blue, and I know I've explained this many, many times in many lectures, but I guess I'll go over it again. This is an I Love Lucy rerun, but there's been a philosophical attack on teleology because it smacks of spirituality in some ways. And so there's been an attack on it to say that there is no objective purpose in nature. And like one example of this attack is the attempt to conflate, say in English, the questions how and why. Like, I always mention this point, I remember being in school and the teacher is saying, you know, we used to wonder how the sky, we used to wonder why the sky is blue, we now know why the sky is blue. And they just give you a simple explanation of atmospherics and optics and everything. And, of course, that's how the sky is blue. What science can tell us is how. Science can't tell us why. Science can only tell us how. And so the attempt to say that how and why are the same question is an attack on teleology. This distinction was brought out by Bhakta Socrates, an early member of the Hare Krishna movement, about 2,400 years ago in Athens. And he makes this distinction in it's Plato writing it, you know. Plato, out of respect for his guru, always put Socrates as a speaker, but the protagonist is dialogue that's written. But there's a work written, and it may be historically accurate, but it's called the Phaedo, Phaedo. And so it takes place in the jail, You know, Elvis did the Jailhouse Rock, and Plato did the Jailhouse Dialogue. So.
Hello!
Well, hold on. Hey! Come on in!
Hello.
Did I meet you before?
No. I'm Jamie.
Oh, Jamie, how do you do? Come on in. Have a seat, make yourself comfortable. I was just discussing a dialogue written by Plato called the Phaedo, which of course, you probably saw the movie. Anyway, so it's a jailhouse dialogue, take place in jail. Socrates was convicted of corrupting the youth of Athens and offending the gods of Athens. Basically, because he was a philosopher. It's funny because the Hare Krishna movement in Athens, when we were trying to teach Bhakti Yoga there, we were accused of the same thing, corrupting the youth of Athens. Offending the Orthodox religion, so something's never changed. Anyway, so Socrates was convicted, and it's interesting, there's several dialogues. Obviously for Plato, it was a very dramatic thing because Socrates was his guru. And Plato personally witnessed his trial, his conviction, and his execution. In those days, they had this great form of capital punishment where you're allowed to do it yourself, drink hemlock. So you're allowed the dignity of poisoning yourself. I'm being somewhat facetious. Oh, how are you? Mr. Cricket. There's actually three. It's interesting because there was a certain time when Plato was rediscovered or was very popular in Christianity. Like the, he was like the first great Christian philosopher. Augustine was a Platonist. He was a big fan of Plato. And so, in fact, the death of Socrates was seen as somehow analogous to the death of Jesus. You know, it's like Plato, Socrates kind of like a martyr to philosophy, to the truth. And so, in fact, there was one point when he was actually proposed to the Vatican to be a saint. There was so much enthusiasm for Socrates, I mean, way back, but it didn't go through on the grounds that he wasn't a Christian, so. Anyway, in the Phaedo, there's the apology. There's the apology, which is actually the trial of Socrates. You hot?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Just getting some
there was the apology, which is the trial of Socrates, where Socrates defends himself. Then there's a Crito, where another dialogue where. The friends of Socrates come to him in jail and say, we've arranged to get you out of jail, you know, for a jailbreak. Because apparently in those days in Athens, when, by the way, this was the democratic government of Athens. So in those days in Athens, if they sentenced you to death, you weren't really supposed to die, you were just supposed to escape. And that was just sort of a way of seriously banishing you from the city, like you really have to leave. Because if you don't leave, you know, it's like in the old cowboy movies, you know, there's a stagecoach leaving town at high noon, you better be on it. So it's that kind of thing. So Socrates, the friends of Socrates paid the appropriate bribes, and, you know, there was a ship leaving Athens, and they said, we can get you on that ship. And Socrates refused. He refused to break out of jail. He said that, basically he argued that I entered into a social contract with the city of Athens, and I've accepted so many benefits and lived here, and so I have to accept the judgment. So he decided he had to. And he said, by the way, I'm so old now, if I go to some other city, I'll just do the same thing, and I'll get in trouble again. It's like. So he decided to stay. Then there's the third dialogue, the Phaedo, which is Socrates sort of teaching the last day of his life, teaching. So Plato wrote actually three different dialogues just to read. About the trial, the conviction, and this whole thing. Yeah, because, you know, that's been a very shocking thing. See your teacher executed like that. But anyway, so the Phaedo, I think Socrates raises the question that if someone says, why is Socrates sitting here in his jail? And if someone answers, well, he's, the way he's sitting is that his body is built in such a way as a human body, it bends at the joint, so he's sitting. And Socrates says, no, that's how I'm sitting. That's a description of how I'm sitting. It's not why I'm sitting here. Why I'm sitting here is because I chose to honor the judgment of the court. So what Socrates or Plato is saying is that the question how and why are very different questions. So if science says we now know why the sky is blue, the answer is, no, you really don't know why the sky is blue. You know how the sky is blue, but you don't know why it's blue. And to say that when science says it, they sometimes do, because scientists don't take philosophy courses. So to say that we now know why the sky is blue is to say that there is no purpose. Because let's say, for example, I'll show you what I mean, so it's not confusing. Let's say, look at this picture. Can you see this picture back here? Now there's a nice dark blue sky there. So if I say, why is that sky that color? The answer is because the artist wanted it to be that color. Assuming the artist was competent, the artist could have made it any color. But the artist chose that color. So the reason the sky is blue is because the artist made it that way. So similarly, if you say, why is the sky blue? What's the purpose of having a blue sky? Not how is it blue. Not, you know, don't talk about optics and the nature of the Earth's atmosphere and the nature of sunlight and the nature of our eyes and so on. That's how we see the sky is blue. But why is the sky blue? Well, then, because there's an artist. someone wanted it to be blue. That's the teleological answer. That's the answer which accepts that there are objective purposes in the universe outside of our own subjective opinions. So, for example, if a spiritual, as all spiritual groups, traditions say, they all say this, that you were born for enlightenment. Purpose of your life is to get wisdom and to learn about who you really are and what life really is. And then if someone says, well, I think I'm just going to become a pharmacist. So, like, no thanks. If someone says no thanks, then a spiritual point of view would say, well, no, that really is the purpose of your life. Even if you don't know it, even if you don't recognize it, it's still the purpose of your life. It's still why you were born. And so if you don't do it, if you don't seek wisdom, if you don't seek enlightenment, you just missed it. You were supposed to do that, but you didn't do it. And, I mean, the further statement could be made that you'll have to do it sooner or later. And so someone can say, well, why? What if I just, even if I reincarnate, what if I do reincarnate and I just perpetually choose not to get it? I just perpetually choose, like, don't tell me. Like, do you want to know who you really are, ultimately? No, don't tell me. I'm having too much fun. So the idea is that you'll eventually have to get around to it because your own desires will lead you there. Because if you think about it, we have three basic desires. There's all kinds of little lists of things, you know, wisdom traditions. Here's a really nice little list. So we basically have three desires, which are, we desire to exist, and therefore most of us stop at red lights. Well, not in Athens, but let's say if there is traffic coming, then you usually stop at a red light. So we desire to exist, and we take so many measures to keep ourselves alive because we desire to exist. And we desire to be happy, we desire pleasure, and we desire knowledge. In other words, theoretically, like, you know that book Brave New World by Aldous Huxley? I mean, theoretically, you could just sort of get yourself pumped up with drugs and be completely stupid and ignorant and like, I know nothing, I don't want to know anything, I just want to feel pleasurable sensations. But actually, I think what most of us understand is that real happiness involves some understanding of life. Like, for example, I mean, to know things, I mean, just to know, like, what is the world, to know something, like, occasionally to learn something, as opposed to just being sort of, like, joyfully stupid. So, you know, they say ignorance is bliss, but not really. So, we do desire to know. That, I mean, apart from all the practical applications of science, like you can make money from it or whatever, I mean, there has been throughout human history, there have been a lot of people that really wanted to discover, like, who are we, what is the world, and how do things work, and so on and so forth. Or you desire for knowledge, desire just to understand things, to know things. So, ultimately, our desire to exist, I mean, we desire to exist, but on the material level, it's not possible because our existence gets terminated. No matter how healthy we are, it's funny. I saw this really funny T-shirt in Arizona. I'm from the Western United States, and there was this big cactus, and then at the foot of the cactus was this skeleton, and the skeleton was like. Like in this position, so you see the person like died, kind of like nagging, like the skeleton all twisted. And then it said, but it's dry heat. It's a joke because in the West they would say, yeah, it's dry heat, it's really hot, but it's dry heat. So. Any questions or comments on these things? I can just rattle on forever, yes.
That's right. So there isn't really then a specific reason why Krishna would choose to be like very much similar in the Vaikuntha planets to all the other living beings, you know, like in his appearance, and very different, you know, in his appearance from the people in Goloka Vrindavan. I mean, in the Vaikuntha planets, the only difference between him and all the people is just like his little hairs.
Well, I mean, people are, yes. I mean, that's sort of a technical description. The idea is that well, it gets back to the general, the basic idea of a personal God. That's really the issue. That's really the philosophical issue. I mean, those little details are just little details. I mean, obviously, Krishna, everyone knows who Krishna is. Not like young people don't know who he is. But if you could, what I find interesting is the fact that we are persons. I mean, you're a person. I'm a person. We're all persons. And so, you may say, well, like, yeah, so what? I'm a person. Thanks for telling me something I never would have guessed. But the point here is that there are philosophies in the world, like certain forms of Buddhism, and certain forms of Hinduism, and certain forms of actually Christian mysticism. I mean, there are different schools in the world which say that you're not really a person. You're not really a person. That you think, well, something thinks it's a person. But that when you're enlightened, when you actually become enlightened, then you will no longer consider yourself a person. But somehow, what you are now, the center of a personal identity, the center of consciousness, you have free will, and you have will, you have feelings, you make decisions, you have your own thoughts, you have your own private internal existence, which you can share with other people, but ultimately, every one of us has a unique, privileged access to our own internal reality. Each of us is the center of a conscious existence. And so then the question is that really what I am? Or, and so, as I said, there are various schools, certain many Buddhist schools and other schools that say no, that ultimately that's an illusion. I find that philosophy to be perfectly honest, absurd, because for various reasons, but so if we are, let's say we are really persons, that's really who we are. You're really a person. You're really an individual. You really have free will. You're really a conscious individual. Then how did you get to be that way? It's like, why are you that? I mean, if there's a God, why would an impersonal God make personal souls? I mean, why would there be a world at all? Why would the world exist at all? Why would you exist at all? If there was no birth. I mean, you can say it just all happened by chance. I personally believe that just like we now look back on history and we see at certain times people believe things we now consider to be outlandish and absurd. Scientists love to say that. People used to think the Earth was flat, which is actually not true. Because, people actually, even back in Roman times, I mean, they actually measured the curvature of the Earth. So there's kind of like this. Anyway, it's sort of like vanity. We think, oh, people were so dumb before and we were so smart. But, you know, they actually knew the Earth curve. But in any case, if you look at how fantastically sophisticated your own body is, it's like millions of times more sophisticated than a computer. And the idea that it just came from nothing, it's just like the wind blew and the sun shone and sometimes it got cold at night and dust particles sort of like bumped around and then you get this fantastically, fantastically, inconceivably sophisticated computer just from the wind blowing and dust particles bumping into each other and the sun shining.
And stars blowing up.
Huh?
And stars blowing up.
Yeah, stars blowing up and radiation. And just from that, it's just, it's like you have a computer. It's like thinking you can just take a bunch of matter and dynamite it, and when all the dust clears, you've got a computer or something. I mean, it's just, I think it's actually a sort of a form of madness. I think people in the future will look back on that view and think it was just madness. Especially because, unlike ancient times, we have such an advanced understanding of microbiology. And we actually understand almost the infinite sophistication of our own bodies. I don't know what to say. It's just so advanced, it's so sophisticated, it's so complex that it's hard to describe it. I mean, you see a bird flying. I mean, birds, they have this aerodynamic technology which goes far beyond anything we have. There are no planes. I mean, are there any planes that can maneuver like birds? That can reproduce? I mean, there are planes where you just like put two planes in a hangar, you know, and then one of them, you know, suddenly gets a big bulge in its fuselage, and then a little plane comes out, you know, making this cute little engine noise. I mean, imagine the planes are just like, you sort of, you know, let them go and they fly around, find their own fuel, they reproduce. So once you have two planes, you can get a whole fleet. And they find their own fuel. You don't have to put the fuel in, they'll find their own fuel. And they'll interact seamlessly with the environment. And they have these incredible aerodynamics. I mean, anyone ever try to catch a fly? So this, and we're surrounded by, just in that we take it for granted because we're used to it, but just an ordinary fly, a bird, the grass, we're surrounded by this mind-boggling, jaw-dropping, super technology. And we're surrounded by art. Look at, you know, those blown up pictures of snowflakes, of water crystals. I always say, like, just look at entomology, insects. It's like way beyond the barroom scene in Star Wars. So, it's just we're surrounded, it's a universe of art, it's a universe of, like, fantastic technology. And to say that it's just all things bumping into each other. It's funny because even in the atheistic forms of Buddhism, they accept the law of karma. And so if you accept the law of karma, what it means is that the universe is made in such a way that it responds to you, not only just responds to your physical acts, like if you push, something moves, but the universe responds psychologically, because karma includes, it takes into consideration the most subtle psychological nuances of intention. Like you perform an act, you choose to do something. So what was your intention? Like, was it good or bad? Do you mean well? Is it done out of bad, you know, ill will? Why did you do what you do? And so to say the universe, that's become a popular way of speaking now, couldn't find my car keys, but the universe reminded me that they were in that shoebox up in my closet. And the universe, you know, was really good to me. You know, the universe sent me a good job. And whenever I hear people talk like that, I keep wondering, like, do you mean the asteroids? Do you mean like the plate glass window in a hardware store? Like, what part of the universe are we talking about? Like, could you specify which part of the universe is conscious? And which part of the universe somehow is reading your thoughts? Because usually, like these atheistic forms of Buddhism, they say that they do accept the law of karma. So how does the universe know what your intentions are? Like, That entails the universe being conscious. So which part of the universe is conscious? Is it like a wall plug or a dolphin? What part of the universe are we talking about? Or is it that if you get enough of the universe, you get like the whole thing put together, yet somehow there's a cosmic consciousness, and the question is, whose cosmic consciousness is it? Because if you have a cosmic consciousness, it starts to look suspiciously like a god. So the idea is that if you just study the nature of reality, if you study yourself, and there was a European philosopher that did that. He was kind of a far out guy, Descartes of the cards. Anyway, it's a French name. So Descartes, he lived in the 1600s, and he did something which at the time I think was actually quite revolutionary. He said, "Let me imagine that I don't know anything. Let me imagine I don't know anything." And the reason that was quite revolutionary is because in the 1600s you were supposed to know a lot, like everything the priest told you. And you're supposed to know everything that was in the Bible. And so to say, for Descartes to say, "Let me imagine I don't know anything," it's like, what are you doing? But anyway, so he sat down his, I guess, 16th century French lazy boy, rocking chair. So he sat down and he did his meditations. He wrote a book called The Meditations, in which he said, basically he had this project. He said, "Let me say that everything that I think I know, I doubt. I'm going to doubt everything. So that I can't say I know anything with certainty. Everything. I doubt everything." Then he said, "My meditation is there anything that I cannot doubt, that's impossible to doubt, that I must admit that I really know?" And so what he came up with, just for starters, was his famous cogito ergo sum. He said that I can't doubt that I'm thinking right now. I'm thinking. And therefore, since I'm thinking, because to doubt is a mental act. If you say, like, "I doubt that you're really sitting there," I just performed a mental act. Namely, I just doubted something. So Descartes said, I'm thinking. And therefore I must exist, because how could I deny that I exist? Because if I doubt, in other words, if I didn't exist, there'd be no one to doubt. So I obviously must exist, otherwise I couldn't be doubting. He said, "I can't doubt that I exist." And then he actually tried to work his way up to restoring God, that God must exist. And, you know, it's a whole book he wrote called The Meditations. But he feels that starting from that foundation that I know that I exist because I'm thinking. And he wrote the book in Latin, so in Latin it's cogito ergo sum, thinking, therefore I exist. And then he feels he can reason his way to certain knowledge that God exists and I have a relationship with God and so on. It's an interesting book. So the context is I'm going to teach in August. I'm going to be teaching a course at the University of Florida in the religions of India. And so I have to teach Buddhism and the Advaita Vedanta, sort of the impersonal meditation thing, and just all the different religions in Indian history. And so I have to study them naturally to teach it. And it just amazes me that people would want to philosophically commit suicide. I mean, you know, some people physically, I think suicide is really a bad way to go. I don't think people should do it. And some people physically kill themselves, and some people philosophically kill themselves, or try to psychologically kill themselves, because if you accept a philosophy that I'm not really a person, I can sort of meditate my way out of my personal existence, so I'm not a person anymore. I'm some kind of impersonal consciousness. It's like, why do you want to do that to yourself? We have freedom. As individuals, we have certain freedom. Especially, say, in a country like this, you have certain political freedom, you have psychological freedom, you can think what you want, mental freedom. So if you're not a person, where's your freedom? You're just some energy. Where's the... You can't initiate activities. You can't choose to enter into relationships or exit relationships. You can't create, either artistically or intellectually or emotionally. You just can't create. It's like, why would you want to destroy all that? Destroy your own individual existence, your own freedom, your own personal life. It's just as tough as it is. Personally, it's amazing that some people want to do that. And yet there are all these traditions that advocate that. In fact, they call it that. In Buddhism, they have this term, anatman, which means non-self. You're not a person. Yes.
Oh. Can I ask a
question?
How do we know Krishna is God?
How do we know Krishna
is God?
Oh, that reminds me of this funny bumper sticker I saw in Beverly Hills.
You're not in a bumper sticker in Beverly Hills?
Oh, yeah. There's some good ones. So they, because sometimes they have these sort of these fanatical Christian things that say, Jesus is Lord, read the Bible. So they had one that said, Zeus is God, read the Iliad. Anyway, actually we would, I mean, there is one philosophical argument for Krishna. This is a campaign season, right? So I'll stay on message here and talk about Krishna. There is an assumption which was made by the great Christian philosopher Anselm, and also made by the great Krishna conscious philosopher Rupa Goswami. And that is, this is the argument, basically. I mean, that God is infinitely great. The first premise is that God is infinitely great. And therefore, they conclude from that, that that description of God, which is greatest, is also the most true. It's an interesting argument. That was basically Anselm's argument. I mean, the way Anselm put it 1,000 years ago was, God is that being then whom no greater being can be conceived. So if God is infinitely great, if that's a fact, then that conception of God, which is greatest, would be most accurate. Even if it's not perfect, it still would be truest because it's the greatest conception, and therefore it most efficiently describes an infinitely great being. Did you follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, now, no one's going to really accept God just based on some tricky philosophical argument. But the point is that Krishna, how should I put it? The nature of science is, I mean, why do you accept anything? If you think very simply, why do you accept anything that's true? Like, why do you believe that you're here right now? And why do you believe you're a person? Why do you believe that you're in a room? I mean, for example, right now, you're seeing this room, and you believe that it really exists, and you're in the room. And, I mean, it does. I'm not trying to play with your minds here. So let's assume that, you know, we believe we're in this room, and we really are. Let's say we really are in this room. Now, imagine your experience of, let's say, watching a movie of a room, or dreaming about a room, or seeing a painting of a room. And if you think about it, what, those are all experiences. If you're, say, on TV or other intellectual media, let's say if you're watching TV or you're in a movie and you see a room, or let's say you're having a dream of a room, or if you see a painting of a room, or being here. Now, somehow or other, you have the ability to compare all those experiences. Let's say it's the same room. Let's say, like, there's a motion picture of a room, and there was a painting of that room, and you dreamed of that room, and you actually sat in the room. So those are all experiences of the same room. And yet somehow or other you have the ability to put those all in order, like in a hierarchy. And in that hierarchy, although those are all experiences of the room, this being in the room is the winner, as most real. There's a sense in which actually being in the room, like we are now, is somehow more real than seeing a movie of the room. They're both experiences of the room. And even when you have a dream, and at the moment you're dreaming, you think it's real, but when you wake up, you make a distinction. In other words, imagine you're in this room right now, and let's say I just will not stop talking, and eventually you fall asleep. And let's say, as you fall asleep, you dream of this room. You dream of the same room. And then you wake up, oh my God, he's still talking. You wake up, and then you see the room. You have the ability to rate those. Like, okay, this experience now when I'm awake is more real than my experience of dreaming of the room. And this is more real than my experience of seeing the room. Now, how do you do that? That's my question. How do you do that? How do you rate those experiences? Like, okay, number one, most real. Number two, second most real. How do you do that? It's something we do constantly, but how do we do it?
I remembered events from my childhood that my family didn't remember at all. Mm-hmm. They wondered if I might have, like, re-dreamed them and, like, added things in.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, well, in that case, it's a slightly, I mean, it's an interesting question, but it's a slightly different case because it deals with memory. And as we know, memory, and we all, I think, should be old enough to know that our memory can deceive us. But let's talk, but to keep it on the simplest level, let's say a case where you're actually in the room now. And let's say you're in the room now, you had a dream about this room, you saw this room in a movie, because this room has been used in many blockbuster movies, obviously. And, or let's say you see a painting of a movie. What power is it that you possess to put all those in order in terms of their degree of reality?
It's shared experience.
What?
It's shared experience.
Yeah, but...
Your interaction.
Your what?
Your interaction with it.
Yeah, but you see, that's really kind of getting around the point, because you say, I had all these different experiences, the word experience means there's an interaction. I mean, you can't really experience anything unless there's some kind of interaction going on. Something.
Just how you feel? Whatever feels most like the room?
Resolve.
That you're in the room?
Well, I don't mean, it's not an emotion. It's like you could be totally, like, I have no feelings about it at all. Like,
could it be something that was familiar?
You want to... Explain more to me.
Just something that feels like you've seen it before or felt it before. And you make that connection. That it's something that you've seen before. And
like the room?
Yeah.
Okay, but let's say that you're saying... Well, let's say... Okay, let me see if I can make this more clear. Because
there are things that do not.
Well, I mean, because like you're in the room right now,
mm-hmm.
And so you know I'm in a room. You know, it has four walls, it has windows, and so on. And then let's say someone actually filmed this little thing we're doing now, and then you watch the film on YouTube. And you're like the millionth person to see it that day. So you would somehow know that being in the room like we are right now is somehow more real than just watching a movie of being in the room. And so anyway, I don't want to confuse everybody, so I'll just get to the point I mean. And that is that it must be the case that there are, that we just have the ability to make those distinctions. That we just It's not like a trick question or something, or some super clever answer. It's just somehow or other, we have that ability. We somehow have that ability. So if you're watching a movie in this room, you know it's not the same thing. So in the same way, as far as knowing, that's the point you're trying to get back to, that as far as knowing that God exists, let's say, I mean, there's two points. There's knowing in general that God exists, and knowing that something more about God, like more of a specific nature of God. So, I think basically the argument would be that it's really because of God that we can know anything. In other words, our ability to know anything is a gift of God. And so when you know God, it's actually a greater degree of reality. Just like this, like being in the room is just more real than dreaming about. When you wake up from a dream, you know that being awake is more real than dreaming. And so in the same way, when you realize the existence of God, it's like waking up again. It's like, let's say you're just physically dreaming, you're just lying down dreaming, and then you wake up. And you realize this is reality. So when you understand God, it's like again waking up and realizing this is even a higher degree of reality. And to know God, to realize God, it doesn't mean that it doesn't change. You know, we're still in a room. If you're God conscious or not, you're still in this room, you still have a body. You know, the sky is blue and so on, but it's knowing more about it. I mean, for example, I remember I was, imagine, let's say you put out some great work of art and a dog walks by and just sees it as an appropriate place to spray. And so the dog walks by and just, you know, gives a little spritz or something, a little spray to that great work of art. Now the dog is seeing the painting. Let's say we look at a painting and we recognize it. Like these are people, this is a painting, it's a work of art. The dog looks at it and just doesn't see all that.
So is it possible to use our intelligence, or does it have to be on the basis of the soul as an intelligence to like understand the room?
Well, it gets back to purpose. Let's say, just take some. Let's say, like a hairbrush. Something really exotic that maybe your whole life you never actually see personally. But I mean, imagine a hairbrush. Now, let's say you show a hairbrush to a bird, even a very cute bird, even like a pleasantly chirping cute bird. So you show this hairbrush to a bird. Now the bird sees it. The bird sees the hairbrush. But just doesn't get it. This is a hairbrush. When you look at a hairbrush, you're not only seeing what color it is or what shape it is, but you're seeing that it's a hairbrush. It has a purpose. It was produced for a certain reason. And so your knowledge of its purpose, it's not a separate thing. It's not like, I see the shape and the color of the hairbrush, and then next to it, I see its purpose as some. No, you just see it all at once. Let's say, for example, you have a friend that you love, and you see that person. You don't simply see like that physical form of the person. You see your friend, and you see something that you love. So you're seeing a reality. You're seeing a person. And so there's different levels of seeing. So when you understand there's God, and you look at the universe, or you look at the sky, or anything else, you see a purpose in everything. Just like hairbrushes have purposes, or computers have purposes. Things are built for reasons. So when you understand God, you look at the sky, you look at a mountain, and you see that it's built for a purpose. Everything has a purpose. You look at your own life and you realize you were born for a reason. Everything is meaningful.
I had this engineering book. It was called The Way Things Work. It was all about the difference between like a design that people would automatically know how to use versus like a design that would confuse people, and like automatic function like the majority of populace. It's very neat. I don't know. But it follows like along the same thought.
Could you say a little more about that?
I don't know, I have the book. It was a while ago. Just that like we have natural functions that we go through, and that everything that is made that like people like good designs for tools and
designs that kind of indicate what how to use them.
Yeah.
So you exactly. Can be friendly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you look at another person, it's like I could look at another person and say the purpose of this person is to gratify me. In other words, imagine someone, let's say, that is looking for sex, just to give a wake everybody up here. And imagine someone is looking for sex. And so it's like, you know, it's like the Terminator, it's like match, not match, you know, it's just like he sees everyone, it's just either it's a match or it's not a match. And so if someone is lusty, if someone wants sex, it's like not a match, possible match. You know, it's just like, and so you're not considering whether that person has some higher purpose. Or you may look at a person and say, this person has a purpose which is to know God. Or this person has a purpose which is to somehow give me their money. Like if I can somehow or other bamboozle this person and take their money, that'd be a great thing. Or if I can use this person to gratify my desires, as opposed to seeing this person exists for their own purpose. This person has to be happy in their own right. This person is not an object of my pleasure, but is the subject of their own pleasure. And ultimately, that person is the subject of God's pleasure, meant to please God. And so, it's like levels of reality and purposes. And so clearly, to accept Krishna as God, ultimately, I mean, there is a God, so, like, the real God, please stand up. So, it's, God can take many forms, God can appear in many different ways, because an infinitely, just look at the universe, God is obviously infinitely creative, so an infinitely creative person can probably figure out more than one way to comb his hair. So,
yeah.
So God can appear in many different ways. Even isn't it in this world people go through different fashions? Like, oh my God, you cut your hair. It's like, or you used to have your hair this way, now your hair is that way. You used to dress like this, now you dress like that. And God is infinite creativity, but ultimately, Krishna. When you accept Krishna, you would have to be persuaded that you would have to have an experience that persuaded you that this is real. Because without that experience, and someone might accept on faith because... But even why would you do that? Sometimes people accept things on faith just because they don't care that much about it. It's like... In other words, I accept a lot of things on faith just because I don't care that much about them. I don't want to investigate. It doesn't make any difference to me. For example, I've heard that, I don't know, maybe like Mozambique is a country in Africa, and so, okay, I've never been there, but I'll take your word for it. And every atlas I've ever seen says there's a country called Mozambique. Used to be a Portuguese colony. And so, fine, like I really don't care, you know, it's, okay, there's a country. So we can accept certain things just because they don't really affect our lives. It has nothing to do with my immediate life, and so we just accept it. But to accept something that really is important to you, you have to have a relevant experience. So to accept Krishna, you'd have to have a relevant experience of Krishna. And the other than practice. Are you going to serve some prasadam?
Yes.
Anyway, I guess we'll wrap up because I don't want to go on too long. So any last questions? Refunds? No refunds. Yes.
Some of the scientists say that, you know, they
they do not want to accept, you know, like the, that there is like a God or something like that as the origin of everything, because it puts into like their study something that they cannot
control
or measure, like something that.
Well, that sounds like a really sound principle, that I only accept as real things that I can control. Sounds very logical. Not. It's, I mean, can you imagine that, having as like a ground rule? Okay, nothing, we can't say anything exists unless we can control it. And then, surprise, surprise, I come up with a universe in which everything is just dead mad, in which, you know, there's nothing but things I can control. If there is a God, you can't control God. So if you rule out a priori things you can't control, that just sounds like, that doesn't sound like science, it just sounds like control. It sounds like your interest is not really knowledge, your interest is just controlling things. Some people are like that in relationships. Some people are not interested in relationships in which they can't control other people. They're not the greatest people to hang out with. But there are people like that. Like, if you enter into a relationship, they have to control you. And if they can't control you, they don't want to be in the relationship. Isn't it? I mean, there are people like that. And sometimes they become captains of industry. So... So I think that's not a healthy psychology, being fanatically committed to only things you can control.
So you would say that the methodology has to change?
I would say the methodology has to be expanded, diversified. I mean, the controlled experiment is a really good way of going about certain things. And it's a really useless way of going about other things. So I give the example, let's say you take a thermometer. Thermometers measure heat. And so if you say, a thermometer is a scientific instrument, therefore if I want to know how far it is from the Earth to the Moon, I can hold up a thermometer. And then I realize, oh my God, right now in Athens it's 68 degrees from the Earth to the Moon. And so I said, wait a second, you can't measure space with a thermometer. Well, why not? It's a scientific instrument. So you not only have to say that a particular method is scientific, you have to show that the application is rational. So to apply the controlled experiment to something which could exist is infinitely greater than you is irrational. It's actually irrational. So you're not being scientific. On that happy note, mm-hmm. Hey, thank you all for coming by. It's a pleasure to meet Jamie and Nick as well. You're your student here?
Not really. The connection of feelings.